Ooh, welcome to PCMC. It's Halloween 2022, and we're here on a Monday. Well, it's because I have an extra episode for you this spooky season. That's right, 5 episodes this October. Today I'm talking to the director David Weiner. He's been on the show twice before. He has directed the films In Search of Darkness, In Search of Darkness 2, and In Search of Tomorrow. His new documentary film, In Search of Darkness 3, is coming out soon, and he's here to talk about how you can get involved, and we're going to talk about the project. It's a fun episode. We've got still some more Halloween coming for you this Wednesday on our normal Bat Time and Bat Station. Here's David Weiner. I'm here with David Weiner, back on the show. We know him as the director of In Search of Darkness, In Search of Darkness 2, In Search of Tomorrow, and the upcoming In Search of Darkness 3, The Final Journey into 80s Horror. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah. In Search of Darkness 3, I'm just going to throw that out real quick. Like, now's the time to jump on it. Between now and Halloween is when we're offering it. And we're offering it in through this little window between now and Halloween, where if you want a physical copy in your hands, if you want a keepsake that has your name on it in the end credits, now's the time to get it, because you'll never get that opportunity again. We can talk all about that down the road. But I'm in pitchman mode, because I'm excited, having done now the longest In Search of Darkness movie yet, based on fan demand. We're at 5 hours and change now, and it's all because backers and fans have said, I love part one, I love part two even more. Let's really do a deep dive into, you know, the video store dusty shelves, bottom shelf, you know, straight to video, shot on video, all of, there's just so much that happened in this decade. 14 hours of a trilogy still can't capture it.
Does that surprise you at all? Because I got to say, I love both films, but I also prefer In Search of Darkness 2. Mm-hmm. So you would think, okay, the first one has more kind of marquee titles, but that's not what us real down and dirty fans, we really want to get in there.
Well, it's like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. If I just said, well, you know, the Freddy and Jason and Michael and Leatherface and Pinhead and Chucky, so we're not going to talk about them. Everyone would be like, what? That's like a requirement. So, you know, if you lean on the heavy hitters the first time out, I mean, I had plenty of eclectic titles in between that. A lot of the response was, yeah, I know this stuff already. You know, I know these guys. I really show me something new. So fortunately, we had the encouragement to do a part two. And that really gave me an opportunity to do more international titles, Italian horror, just a lot of straight-to-video stuff, and just really get a better sense of what 80s horror had to offer. And I kind of thought that was it. And then people were like, more, 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 more. And the people who said more, 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 know full well that there are hundreds and hundreds of titles that came out in that 80s decade alone. Cult genre horror stuff. And so this time around, the focus is essentially really, really, really deep in the mire of those dusty bottom shelves of the video store, with the exploitation titles, shot on video, straight to video stuff. But also, believe it or not, there's plenty of theatrical stuff we still have yet to cover. Nice. So Serpent in the Rainbow, you know, Monkey Shines, Jaws the Revenge, you know, The Hand by Oliver Stone's first film with Michael Caine, you know, all this stuff. There's this, you know, Prom Night. Can you believe we haven't done Prom Night yet? We touched on it.
Yeah.
We were talking about, like, you know, the sort of seasonal horror genre, subgenre, but we didn't do a sort of solo shot on Prom Night. So there's so many ripe apples for the picking this time around, with so many left to go. But I think capping it all with a nice 14-hour trilogy is, I think that's a pretty decent exploration into a decade. What do you think?
I think so. So do you feel done?
Yeah. I feel like I'm up for a good night's sleep after this. Yeah. But I'll never be done, because I love this stuff. This is my bread and butter. I love movies, and I love genre film. I love sci-fi. I love horror. I love fantasy. I love every decade of filmmaking. I mean, I bleed this stuff. I have my preferences, sure, but there's just so much to talk about. And as long as the backers and the fans and folks like you who just love this stuff through and through and will devote your free time to do podcasts about it, want more films of the types that I'm making,
Right.
I'm more than happy to oblige with Creator VC guiding me.
Well, thank you for the
No,
14
thank
hours
you. No, thank you.
of so 14 hours, 14 screen time hours later, I'm sure many, many more hours of work later. Do you feel like at this point you do understand 80s horror films more than you understood them before? I'm sure you knew
Absolutely.
a lot, but I mean, like, really, like, understand what was happening.
I was there when they first came out, so I was seeing many of them in real time. And like I said, hundreds and hundreds. So I just didn't see them all, and nor did I try. But now I have an excuse to see many, many, many more. And I revisited so many films this over the course of these three films, where I gave them a much more fair shake this time around, because they're a time capsule of the era, or I have more respect for the franchise characters or the filmmaker. And even if it's not arguably a critically acclaimed, success, I have a greater appreciation for what it has to offer and the creativity and just the sense of the time period. And back then, I was a teen. I was born in 68, so I was a 70s kid and an 80s teen. And so while I was watching all these movies, I just wanted blood, guts, TNA, and entertainment. That's all I cared about. There was no political message, meant nothing to me at that age, but as one gets older and climate and history repeated, climates change and history repeats itself, you start paying attention to that kind of stuff, and you start being more interested in what filmmakers were either intentionally or maybe subconsciously trying to convey. And so I look at these a lot more differently. And I look at the big iconic franchises more differently as well.
Really?
I got a little more cynical, as one might do in their teens. I'm a total like starry-eyed optimist now, but when you're a teen, you get cynical about stuff. And I would see through a lot of, the like I'd see Pinhead, or I'd see more Freddy movies, or I'd see more Jason movies. I'd even see more Michael Myers movies that I loved all the stuff when they first came out. But the once I kind of saw what the producers were seeing, which were dollar signs. And they're like, they just want to create an iconic character to build a franchise on so they could cash in. And I don't think they care where these stories go. They just want to make sure that they're sort of rinse and repeat. And so I didn't care for a lot of the sequels, nor did I care sometimes for an original film. Hellraiser came out and I looked at Pinhead and I'd say to myself, let me preface that I love Hellraiser and Hellraiser 2 even more. But when I first saw that, I was in no race to catch it, because I'm like, yeah, they just wanted to create another Freddy or Jason, or Leatherface came back because like Leatherface has to come back. He might have been before everybody, but he's got to play catch up now, so we can put him on, t-shirts and lunch boxes. I look at all I this is obviously a very long answer to your question, but I look at all this stuff from a very different retrospective lens now, and I have a much greater appreciation for all of it and all how it all plays into this decade.
Well, I think, I've watched part one and two both numerous times, and I think as fun as the list format is, I think I really love the in between of
The
the
chapters, right?
topics. When you do a deep dive into something.
That is absolutely crucial when I make these films, because the whole idea at the very beginning when we crowdfunded this for In Search of Darkness was, let's do year by year all the movies, all the horror movies of the 80s, and that's not possible. And also it gets a little redundant and repetitive, just by virtue of the structure. And I think there's so many conversations to be had, so many topics to tackle, so many controversies to put the spotlight on as to why, that in all of these films, one of the things I love I love all of the way I get to approach these things, where we talk about individual films and
Right.
larger context chapters. But I think that these chapters are very important in creating context for the decade, in terms of what filmmakers were looking at and trying to do, in terms of what trends were being followed, in terms of what was happening in the real world, that affected filmmaking and how filmmaking responded to what was going on in the pop culture, the politics, the socioeconomic issues of the time. I mean, it's all there and it's ripe, again, ripe for the picking.
Right. You know, it's interesting because the 80s now is sort of like, the 50s was in the 80s, during or the 70s when you like had Happy Days and American Graffiti, so many things like from Stranger Things to My Best Friend's Exorcism to Paper Girls are all set in the 80s. And but there is a lack of context. I'm sure the same is true for the 50s, right? The 50s was not great for everybody. But I do love that these films do give context. I mean, I think I'm very entertained by some of the clips you use of like Ebert or Roger Ebert more than Gene Siskel. Sometimes was very conservative when it comes to the way he talked about films. As much as I liked him, sometimes he would have such a weird reaction to things. But it's like you do have to understand the context of how conservative that whole time was. You had Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. So yeah, like this. That's the reason why we had so much blood and guts in the movies, because the kids were fighting back in a way.
These movies are sort of the ultimate rebellion, cinematically, to what was going on. And if there was a pushback, I mean, horror kind of became a bit of a pariah for much of the decade, whether you're in the UK with the video nasties or sort of the satanic panic pushback. That also involved music, but for all the pushback on the music and Tipper Gore and Congress, trying to label albums and, make sure our kids weren't, playing records backwards because they were all, going to be pawns of Satan. You got
Open the
films
gate.
like Trick or Treat and, Rock and Roll Nightmare and Black Roses pushing back saying, well, screw you, man. We're just going to amp up the volume on, and point out how ridiculous their stuff really is. Because it was the moral majority was a vocal minority, but it took such a very firm hold in the media because people were I mean, it goes back to the late 60s. You look at Rosemary's Baby, and then you look at The Exorcist, and you look at The Omen, and all of a sudden Hollywood's jumping on this. But then the media is pu sorry, the moral majority is pushing back, saying, "Well, you're indoctrinating our children." You only need one person to say that, and everyone picks up on it because it's a good story, and it the hysteria aligns with their political agenda, whatever it may be, to the point where history repeats itself, as I said. So present day, Hocus Pocus 2 comes out, and all of a sudden some woman says, "Beware what comes through your television on Disney Plus. It's supposed to be safe, but now my kids are." They're going to join a coven and be devil worshippers because the Sanderson sisters told them so. Listen, if she doesn't want to expose her kids to that, that's her right. And I believe that she should be watching what her kids are watching. And if she doesn't agree with it, then all power to her to turn off the television. But to be warning the world, obviously, she didn't expect to warn the world, but we all picked up on it because it's clickbait. For a lot of websites and news organizations, just to get eyes and get discussion going over something. It's silly, but it also is not because it's part of a larger movement that we have to be incredibly wary of.
Well, I was very excited to be able to get a little preview of the new film, a little taste of it, which was great. And one of the topics that was in the preview that I'm glad you got to, and you just mentioned, it was video nasties. I don't know if can you explain the video nasties? Because I think maybe a younger audience might not even understand the power of VHS.
I think that concept, the video nasties, gets bandied about a lot. But that was in the UK. That was in England, and the United Kingdom. And that was not the similar things were happening here in the United States in the 80s as part of this sort of generally titled Satanic Panic. But what it ultimately came down to is because of the video revolution and the easy access to movies if you're underage, then the censors really clamped down, and they literally did a hit list of a bunch of films that they called the video nasties. They turned, you know, it was that was not the official title, but that's what everyone in the tabloids called them. But what happened was the pushback was absolutely serious, you know, and so people were debating if this was healthy or going to lead you down a path of emulating these films and killing people because you saw killing on these films, you know, to the point where even like, you know, a Cannibal Holocaust, people were wondering that would go to court because someone thought that that was a snuff film that everyone had access to and was like the reason why we have this hit list to avoid the video store, or video store couldn't carry them. Or even sometimes people would even own them and they'd get raided by the police because they thought it was a snuff film.
Wow.
So it was getting serious.
You got Faces of Death too.
Faces of Death, which is arguably a snuff film, but it's all staged, but people didn't know it at the time and people wanted to. I was one of those people who got that bootleg tape. My friend said, we have Faces of Death. We popped in the TV, we locked the door, and we watched this horrified, saying, oh my God, people were rolling around in blood and guts in a devil worship sequence. Wait a minute, this is a little convenient. Really?
How is their coverage of...
Yeah, exactly. This is very well produced. It gets people talking. It's forbidden fruit. And it gets controversial. And because it's controversial, more people pay attention and pick sides. And it's always been that way, and it always will be that way. But in the 80s in particular, because of the preponderance of these films easily available by way of video stores and otherwise for younger kids who normally wouldn't be able to get to see this stuff, whether it was on cable, whether it was videotape, or whether it was being able to make a bootleg tape by recording, you know, from one thing to another. That's the thing, is all of a sudden it was a problem that we had to deal with. And next thing you know, 2020, Geraldo Rivera, you know, they're all doing shows saying, beware what your kids are doing. We're going to you know, court. Sorry, we're going to Congress. You know, Frank Zappa and Dee Snider of Twisted Sister are going to have to defend their work in front of Congress because the art on the album covers and the lyrics are suggestive and demonic and pornographic, and all our kids are listening to this, and we need to protect our kids. And you know what? They weren't wrong. What happens is that it becomes a fine line between warning and censorship, and that's why this stuff has to be safeguarded and fought and discussed and regulated. That's reasonable.
Right.
The last I'll say on it is what happens is we get quick to ban things. Like, you'd think in this day and age, people wouldn't be banning books, but look what's happening, right? So it's a very slippery slope. And I think a solid parental guidance suggested warning is valid and needed for people who don't have the time to figure out themselves if something is good for their children. But it's suggested, parental guidance suggested, not required.
Right.
And that's the huge difference and what we need to be wary of always.
Yeah. It was in some ways a looser time. I mean, like, I would go to the video store. There were two video stores in my neighborhood, and there was only $2 to rent a movie. A new release would be like $3, but you know, like an old horror movie, which is where I would go. It'd be $2, and I'd take the little tab off of the thing. And every Nightmare on Elm Street, every Friday 13th. I mean, I was like 10, and I guess they knew my mom and dad, so okay. But it was
it wasn't their job to police it. You know,
No.
I mean, maybe if you accidentally wandered into that back room with the creaky doors, they might be a little more proactive in stopping you.
Right. That couldn't happen.
When it came to horror, it was all out there for all to see. Like, listen, sometimes the horror section was right next to the Disney family section. Like, and it's like, even then I was like, well, maybe you should separate them. But if you've got a small store and that's, you know, you want to put the two things that rent the most, horror and Disney, you got to put them right there where people can see, and there's
right,
all this
right.
nuance to the thought process.
And hey, I turned out okay.
Arguably, we all did. Arguably.
Yeah, I mean, no, I ended up becoming a movie freak and going to school to study films. And so if there was any effect it had on me was I didn't become more violent. I just became more into art. So that was the effect on me.
Art, if I learned one thing in my education, it was something that was valuable about art. And that was that art is what the beholder perceives it to be.
Yeah.
And so while one person's art may be another person's, my three-year-old could do that on a piece of paper, you know? And that goes for any, you know, I think some art is universally regarded as absolute art, but there's this experimental art that goes into territory where you think it's art or it's not. But you could also put a paint splatter on a sidewalk and someone could like say, this is a shrine because it's right. amazing to me because, and that's what it all comes down to is what you perceive to be art and you hold dear and want to champion.
That's well, in that vein, that's one of the things that I really like about this series is, I mean, it's not presenting all of these films as quote unquote art, but it's presenting them as cultural artifacts that deserve to be remembered, you know, and sometimes you'll have a big movie next to a much smaller title, but it's like they have the same weight in a sense. It's like this came out the same year, you know, it's the same community making these things. And if you remember this one, maybe it would be good to also remember this one. I really love that almost like eschewing of value judgment.
It's very true. I mean, what's very important for me in all of these films that I make, these documentaries, these long form documentaries, is when you do demonstrate what happened in any particular year, that it all has to be on an even playing field. You know, and so I usually, you know, I will often reference a, you know, critical response to a particular film, but I'm not judging based on that critical response. I'm just saying that there was a positive or a negative critical response. It did great at the box office. It
right.
did terrible and no one saw it. But what we're really talking about is why is this film important to discuss?
Right, right.
And arguably, a lot of these films that are considered pop culture trash and disposable from a certain decade, especially many decades later, are absolute time capsules of the era.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of pop culture to chew on, whether it's the the sociology of the people and their interactions and the casting or what was not cast, who was not cast, or how a person, you know, or minority representation or marginalization takes place in a film, whatever walk of life you are. This is all about an era and the choices that were made by the filmmakers and how people voted with their dollar to go see these films or receive them. And
yeah.
there's so much more information there if you choose to recognize it than, you know, dismissing it, which is also something people love to do.
Sure, sure, of course. So how did In Search of Darkness 3 end up being so long? Do you have more films in it or just dive deeper on things?
Yes. there's more. Well, after we did part one and part two, which were both about 4.5 hours, I thought even after part two, I figured, you know, people got their share of it and they probably didn't. And that's enough for everybody. But people really responded in the direction that we went with part two and said, I could watch more and more and more of this. And so when I looked at the content that would be available for part three, I really thought to myself, you know, is this scraping the bottom of the barrel or is this like a whole rich world that we have yet to even tap, you know, in this?
Yeah.
And that's really the answer that was my answer. You know, we involved everybody who loved part one and part two. And we surveyed the backers and we surveyed everybody saying, what would you want to see in part three? Because you've asked for it. We're going to do it. Now, what do you want?
Yeah.
It's all yours. And we got write-ins and we did a poll and people voted on them. And I don't want to give any answers away.
Sure.
You know, but, you know, because I want plenty of surprises. But if anything, the rallying cry was more and longer. And with In Search of Tomorrow, we really did need to go based on the demands of the structure and the content. We were able to go to 5 hours. And I just thought, this is the final installment of the trilogy. This is what people want. And if they're here for it, why not give them more? And I
Right.
figure 5 hours and change is really the way to go. But we've
Right.
got 79 movies that we cover in each
Wow.
across the years. Plus, there's a chapter in between for every single one.
Right,
So
right.
we have a little more time to chew on this stuff, and we also have more content to go over. And it's still not enough, and it's still not going to
Right,
be all
right.
the movies, and there's still going to be titles where you're going to. I will undoubtedly get messages saying, "What a crime. You've done 14 hours and you still didn't do this title.
Right.
Why? That's crazy." But for that title, then there's other titles that other people wanted. And sometimes they're more popular, and why wouldn't I put it in there? And sometimes I just didn't have the right people or alchemy to put it in when there was something
Right.
else that was better. I mean, there's a thing that I experience where if you look at the decade and you look at all the films that come out, once you hit 85, 86, 87, 88, and 89, especially, there was just so much more. Because towards the end of that decade, everyone was saying we could make a quick, down and dirty film. We could even shoot it on video and get it to a mom and pop store, and there it is. And it'll never be in a theater, but people will rent it because it's got an insane cover and a good title. And so those are more valid this time around than some of the really well-known titles because that's really kind of the focus this time around.
What is there any sort of criteria in terms of like, we won't do a TV movie, or it has to have been a VHS?
Well, it's not has to have been VHS because I do lots of theatrical stuff.
Okay.
Well, yeah, it did have to be a VHS because all this stuff did end up either going theatrical, then to VHS,
Yeah.
or straight to VHS, or shot on video and straight to VHS. That's
Wow.
all kind of the qualifications, but I don't do any of the TV stuff just because, sure, there was plenty of cool TV things, but the thing is, there's so much going on.
I know.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And there's still lots of topics that I wanted to tackle that I want to keep as a surprise, but I just, those were more important because the TV is a whole other realm, and there's so much there. I loved watching the Friday the 13th TV series, which anyone who doesn't know about that, it's a great TV series, but it's much more about sort of Tales from the Crypt and X-Files, and it has nothing to do with Jason. It's about a haunted antique shop where anything that's sold from this haunted antique shop basically makes people go crazy and kill each other, for whatever the reason of that
Right.
week. And so it was almost like the X-Files. They had to track
Right.
down these artifacts each week and return them to this haunted antique shop. And I loved it. And it was only Friday the 13th in name, but
Right.
between that and Tales from the Crypt
Freddy's Nightmares?
Freddy's Nightmares, like all this
Yeah.
great stuff, it was out there. But listen, maybe I have to make a whole movie on that.
So, without naming any names, have you gotten any messages from any filmmakers or actors saying, "Thank you so much for including my movie because now people remember it again"?
Absolutely, I have.
How does
And
that
there's
feel?
filmmakers this time around that when we are finally covering their films and we track them down to talk about their films, they're like, "Yeah, that sounds great. I'd love to do
Awesome.
that." Or, "Really? People care? Like they didn't know, And they're happy to talk about that. And that feels incredibly rewarding. I mean, then at that point, I feel like I'm doing a service. I went to Monster Palooza this past weekend. And so many of the people who I've interviewed and are in our films were there. And I went to a nice cross section of them, some where the lines were huge and I just didn't want to bug them, But others, I had an opportunity to like come and thank them for being in my film. And they're like, "No, thank you." I get so much more reactions and response, and people are constantly saying, "I love seeing you," and In Search of, Darkness 1 or 2.
That's awesome.
And there said, I mean, Robert Ressler, I was just talking with, who was in, Vamp and all sorts of great stuff and Weird Science. He's like, "I'm a fan of yours because I love this stuff. I love it. And I'm so happy to be part of it." It was very cool. I got to do that with Nancy Allen, too. I
That's
had to kind of
awesome.
illuminate her. I'm like, people are saying so many wonderful things and happy to see you in In Search of Darkness and In Search of Tomorrow. She's like, you're kidding me. I'm like,
Wow.
yeah, no, it's like the cacophony is out there. She's like,
That's
oh my God, really? You know, so it's nice.
very nice. So, I guess this is sort of the last thing we'll get into, but all month long on all of our Halloween episodes, we've been talking about witches and witches in pop culture. I'm wondering, what are some of your favorite witches from pop culture, movies, anywhere?
I it's funny, I have a love-hate relationship with witches.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because witches are interesting to me, but I always in my mind kind of go back to Hansel and Gretel. You know, that to me was probably the first witch story that I ever heard. And so whenever I see witches in all sorts of media, especially modern witches, I appreciate them. And some of the movies I love, some of the movies I don't as much. But I always find myself going to sort of the classic Grimm fairy tale style of witch as the one that really kind of disturbs me, because that's the one I know wants to just trick and eat children.
So, how do you feel about Deborah Harry's witch in Tales from the Dark Side, the
Tales from
film?
the Dark Side, the movie. It's great. Well, because she, versus Debbie Harry, it's Blondie, right? So you're like, she can do no wrong. Let's trick or treat at her house, you know? And oh my gosh, you know? Yeah, it's, I loved it. That's the thing is, you know, a great witch is a deceptive witch. You know, a great witch is a witch who is not a witch in appearance, because their big deal is they want to deceive you to get what they need from you. I mean, the other witch that I've always loved comes from the Bugs Bunny cartoons. I mean, witchy, she was it Witch Hazel? Is that her name? Yes. You know, she laughs and then disappears, and her hairpins are still in their place, you know? But I mean, that was always my favorite when Bugs Bunny shows up with a mask and she thinks that he's a witch. And then wants to, you know, it's always about making, you know, what rabbit stew. So I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of all over the map with my answer, but I really enjoyed The Witch recently. You know, that one with Anna Taylor, what is it? Anna Taylor Joy? Anna, I always, yeah. She's wonderful. She's a find, and she's in everything now, deservedly so. But you know, some of the modern day stuff. I know you covered, you know, Nicholas Roeg's witches, the Roald Dahl witches. I love that, and I couldn't wait to watch the Bob Zemeckis remake because I was interested, and it just made me want to go back to the world of Jim Henson and the original. Angelica Houston can do no wrong with everything she does when she has her, you know, a toe dipped in horror. You know, whether it's the Addams Family or the witches, that stuff was disturbing as a kid's movie, and it's like the ultimate gateway horror film, the witches, and. I don't want to disparage remakes and reboots, but it's easy. And all I could just say is when I watched the remake, all I could think of was that even though I thought Anne Hathaway was great, it just made me want to go back to the design and the atmosphere of the first more and more as the film was going on. But I mean, witches to me, I'm more like Boyle, you know, like Rand Cauldron and, you know, Boyle, toil in trouble, and you know, the three witches sharing an eye in you know, the Stygian witches in Clash of the Titans is another. Yeah, it's all stuff. I mean, I love the, you know, the I can go on for days about this stuff, you know. There's lots of stuff, but I really like the, you know, like Witch Finder General of 1968, you know, you know, it's sort of the Edgar Allan Poe approach to things. You know, you got Vincent Price, you know, all the Hammer horror stuff. That's the stuff I really gravitate to and I really love.
Thank you so much for being here. Can you tell us one more time where we can get involved in Search of Darkness 3?
Yeah, go to 80shorrordoc.com between now and Halloween. Halloween midnight. At the stroke of midnight, it's almost time, kids.
So
The
you'll have
clock
plenty
is
of time when you
ticking.
hear this.
But yeah, go there, and that's when you could get either the film by itself, or if you can get if you haven't gotten the other films, you know, this is all about the physical copy, holding it in your hand. So if you want to get the trilogy, you could buy the trilogy in a box set, Or you say, I got one or two, but I didn't get the other. Now's your chance to play catch up and get all three. But there's all sorts of cool stuff. There's, you know, swag. There's three amazing posters, digital download of the film, digital download of the soundtrack, a really cool video card. It looks like it's a membership card that we made, but it's got merch deals on it that looks like a video membership card. But maybe most importantly is that the thing is, you act now. We're not going to be doing this again. You can only now get your name in the credits, and it becomes like a keepsake. Like, you get to be personally responsible for carrying this over the line and producing it in existence. But you get to live forever knowing that your name is in the credits and you helped this project. Yeah. You can put your podcast in there. You can put your loved one who loved horror movies, and watching horror movies was very important when you watched with your mom or your dad or your uncle. You could put their name in there. You know, and one more thing that we're doing, which is super cool, is because I was talking about how this is really like a community project. All the content was chosen by fans and backers who said, this is what I want you to cover. And I just had a big pile to choose from. It's important for me to give back to the community as well. And because these end credits really can go for quite some time with your name in the credits, one final cool thing that we're doing is I'm asking everyone to do a video testimonial about how much they love 80s horror. Right. So you could talk about, you know, either your favorite film, your favorite filmmaker, even the In Search of Darkness franchise and what it might mean to you, and record a video testimonial just talking from your heart about why you love this stuff. And what I'm going to do is, I can't promise every single one, but I'm going to do as many as I can from top to bottom, where while the credits are going, everyone is talking about why they love horror and how much this means to all of us. You know, and who knows, maybe there won't be a dry eye in the house when we're all done. But in order to do that, all you have to do, and this is open to everybody, is go to our socials on 80s Horror Doc. So at 80s Horror Doc on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You know, there's a Linktree link. You click on that link, and then you'll see a link there showing you exactly what you need to do to record a brief but heartfelt testimonial that ideally we can put in the end credits. And I think that'll be very cool. And it's my way of giving back to the community that has given us so much. And just by the encouragement to do more is allowing us to make more of these movies even in the future.
I think that's super awesome. Because as you said, from film choices to it seems like it's been a conversation with the horror community and the fans and you guys. And that's what I think makes the whole sort of series like special. Mm-hmm. And you've got 14 hours. You know, I think about like when I was a kid and when I would come across like a documentary like this, how much it was like, oh my God, I got to write all these down. I got to see all these. like, I feel like what you've created is going to be required viewing for horror fans. And I think that's awesome.
I think that if you are a hardcore horror fan, I understand if you thought In Search of Darkness 1 was just not your cup of tea, because you know it all. And I say that with reverence. You know, I do not claim to know it all. I know a lot. I know a thing or two about a thing or two, but I know the fans really know their stuff. This is an opportunity to maybe this third time is the charm for you. If there are films out there that you did not even know existed, or at least they're giving some love to the filmmakers who made these, which you don't see very often, which is very, very cool. I mean, we have, 50 brand new interviews in this and 70 interviews total, because we carried over 20 more from the original part one and part two, where we did such long interviews, we didn't even get to that material. So the whole celebration of this era is now 70 people talking about it. I think fundamentally, this covers all the bases from the shallow end of the pool to the deep end of the pool. And wherever you come from in terms of your what you bring to the table in terms of your knowledge, I think you can't deny that this is something for everyone, and especially for people who really want to know more about a decade that's now long gone. It's between 30 and 40 years old right now. Yeah. And many of these films are no longer available, or they're very hard to find, or they're definitely not on people's curation lists. At the very least, this helps you discover new films, new filmmakers, new concepts that you might not have thought about before or want to find out more. And they're this great diving board jumping off point to discover more about 80s horror.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I'm very excited, and I want you to know I am available for In Search of Tomorrow 2, as talking head work. I'm
Yeah.
available. Just let
You're a
me know.
sci-fi. Thank you for throwing your hat in the ring. We are looking to do In Search of, and I can't see when you talk about In Search of Darkness all day, it's very hard to say In
Yeah,
Search
right, I'm
of
sure.
Tomorrow. We want to do that. We want to do In Search of Tomorrow too. And we also want to do In Search of Darkness 90s. And so
Oh,
we are in the very early development stage on
that's
both of
very
those.
cool.
And after I get a good night's sleep, then I could focus on
Yeah,
those.
take a little break. Thank you so much
Figure
for
14
being here.
hours of 80s
I
horror
know.
plus another 5 hours of 80s sci-fi qualifies me for, to
Yeah,
put my feet
sure.
up in a hammock and drink a tiki drink for at least an afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you having me on and for being such a great cheerleader for our projects. And it's very much appreciated. What you do yourself with your podcast, talking about all this great, cool genre stuff, really helps perpetuate interest in a lot. Either we listen to it because we love it and we know it and love to just talk about it, or there are plenty of people who want to know where to start and someone knowledgeable talking about this stuff. It makes all the difference.
Thank you so much. Thank
All right,
you.
guys. Happy spooky season. Take care.
Okay, as David said, the website is 80shorrordoc.com. This has been PCMC. I just want to thank everyone so much for sticking with us all month long. This is the best time of year. We love producing these Halloween episodes, and there's still more to come. We'll be talking about Hocus Pocus on Wednesday. Go bye bye.